All right, for our next installment here at the Postdoc Way, I have my guest, Melanie Cinch. She is the director of the Office of Postdoctoral Studies at Harvard University, and she is a career counselor and a consultant also at her own firm, and previously she was working as a career consultant and counselor at the NIH. She received her master's in education in counseling, so welcome, Melanie.
Thank you very much.
Yes. I was wondering if you can maybe give us a little bit of an introduction of your experience, maybe your background, and kind of fill in some of the gaps or the holes that I left out in my introduction.
Of course, I'd be happy to.
Great.
First of all, thank you so much for inviting me, Brian. It
Sure.
is a pleasure to be talking to you and to all of the listeners about their options, because there are so many options for today's postdocs, and it's important to me to be able to share information with them across the country and hopefully one day globally. So I have been actually serving graduate students and postdocs for about 15 years now. I started out at the University of Michigan's Career Center, where I volunteered when I was in grad school. I volunteered as a peer advisor, and just found that I loved it. I loved serving people and helping people to sort out what is most important to them in a job and in their futures. So it's been inspiring. I've worked with so many amazing researchers and scholars over time, and that's true for people I've met through the National Postdoc Association, people I've met across the country, and it's a real blessing to be able to hear about people's work and their passions every day. So I view this job as a gift.
So your history and your kind of the transition that you made to become a career counselor, I was curious if you can maybe elaborate on that a little bit. You had mentioned you had some previous experience before your current position at Harvard, correct?
That's right. That's right. So I actually, when I started out, I was in graduate school for Russian and Ukrainian history. So I often was asked by several bosses after that, so how did you make the jump from
right.
Russian and Ukrainian history to career counseling? And that really was because I found out through visiting the Career Center at Michigan what the counselors did every day. So I was able to learn more about their jobs. And because I had always been focused on education, careers in education, teaching, advising, I was fascinated. I just thought their job sounded fantastic. So asked to be included in the application process to be a peer advisor, then was trained by the counseling staff there at Michigan. It was definitely the best training I've ever received. And from there, a position opened at Michigan in the Career Center. So that was my first job.
Okay.
And it was great. It was great. I did not have training at the time as a counselor, but the position I worked in was for employers. So working directly with employers who hired at different levels. And it was interesting for me to learn more about the economy and where growth was in terms of jobs. From there, I went to moved to Somerville, Massachusetts, worked in Cambridge as a recruiter for a diversity recruiting firm. And that was terrific because I actually traveled to Madison, as a matter of fact. I was a recruiter responsible for the Midwest and the West Coast.
Oh, great.
So I traveled throughout the Midwest, visiting schools and just trying to match minority students and underrepresented minority students with job openings. And it was fun. I loved being on campus, but mostly I was in an office, and it was exciting. It was it was a startup in Cambridge, but really wanted to be on a campus again. So from there, I went to Bunker Hill, and that's where I feel like I really got my big break. I worked at Bunker Hill Community College, which is in Boston, and my boss there did take a chance on me because I was serving students directly as a counselor, but hadn't had formal coursework or counselor training. So She was also an amazing boss and mentor. She remained a mentor to me for years. She gave me the training that I was missing in terms of serving students and counseling theory, and you know, that was fantastic. Mm-hmm. From there, I moved to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and started there at the Career Center. But in order to accept that job, I needed to commit to going through a master's program for counseling.
Okay.
So earned my master's in North Carolina. And from their main Career Center, where I served graduate students in all disciplines, I was invited to serve as the founding director of the Office for Postdoctoral Affairs at UNC. And that's the beginning of my adventure with postdoc. That was 2001. And it was an exciting time because our office at UNC predated the founding of the NPA. Hmm. So the NPA was founded in 2003. So I was, we were at UNC out in front fairly early nationally. So at the time that the NPA was formed, there were 23 postdoc offices in the country. Hmm. Now there are 167.
Wow.
So in 10 years, that is, that's how far we've come, and it's terrific. And mm-hmm. it's been so exciting to see the development of this field and to work with colleagues over the past decade. It's been amazing, colleagues from all over the U.S. and Canada. So from UNC, then I moved to Connecticut, where I kept in touch with another mentor. She was a faculty member that I worked with very closely at UNC. She served as the faculty advisor for my office. She was instrumental in building the office and securing funds from the provost. And she took a senior level position at the NIH. And she invited me in 2007 to build a career center at the NIH.
Wow.
And so she knew I was in Connecticut, and so I commuted to Bethesda for a while. I visited about twice a month for maybe the first year, but then helped her hire local career counselors to staff the office, helped her build her website, and wrote several handouts for her office, so I was able to keep in touch, mm-hmm. and then offered to serve as author of their careers blog.
Wow.
So I wrote for that office for a while. And then the office of the position at Harvard came up, and have done similar work there in terms of starting up a new office. So very exciting, and have been very fortunate over time through my connections. And that's a story I share with postdocs, not the entire story, but during counseling appointments, just stress to them that mm-hmm. building a network is
exactly.
is one of the most important things you could ever do for yourself mm-hmm. and your career and your development.
Yeah, that's dead on. I mean, yeah, another clear example of how networking really played an important role in your transitions and then where you're at right now. It sounds like at least the last two or three moves were directly, I mean, you made a connection directly because of your network and your position. Maybe this was something you had a fast track to that nobody else would have known, or your mentor kind of sought you out compared to anybody else. I think, yeah, you can't speak enough about how important networking is. And I'm sure as you're counseling people,
yeah.
this is probably something you stress to them as well.
That's right. So what she said is 100% true. Every time it was a personal connection that made the difference for me. And so I do try to stress that to people who come into the office. And what I've heard from postdocs, well, forever, but even recently, as much as we try to write about and talk about and teach about networking, I hear a lot of frustration. I hear frustration from postdocs who have been applying for jobs, maybe some for months, some, you know, in the past year, without getting a response.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not uncommon when people are limiting their job searches to applying to jobs online.
Yes.
So the deeper I dig during our counseling appointments, I'll find oftentimes people are sitting in their labs applying for jobs online and not meeting anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And they feel frustrated, and I don't blame them because they spend a lot of time maybe developing a strong CV and cover letter mm-hmm. and send it out, and that does take time.
Yes.
But not hearing a response is an unfortunate byproduct of I think the movement to online recruiting, and I know it can be frustrating for job seekers, but every time I have a chance to have a conversation with someone, I will just encourage them to spend that time instead leaving the lab and going to talks and reaching out to people. Even if they start online, just to make personal connections, I think is much more meaningful.
Mm-hmm. So along those lines, if you had three pieces of advice to give to somebody, what would you suggest? I mean, obviously the first one is not just sitting in your lab, but if you had to recommend two or three other resources that they could immediately follow and kind of work on at the same time, maybe they're crafting their resume or their CV, what do you generally recommend to people that you're consulting?
Well, I always recommend that people build or improve their LinkedIn profile.
Okay.
And I say that because at this point, we have, in career counseling literature, there are several articles out about it, but essentially, or approximately, 90 to 95% of all employers across all sectors are using LinkedIn now, not to hire people,
right.
but to identify people.
Okay.
So just to find people who have particular skills, everyone is using it. And so for a postdoc not to be on LinkedIn now, I think is, they're missing an easy way to, I think, relatively easy and painless and free
mm-hmm.
To connect with an enormous network of professionals. It's funny, just this past week, I talked to a postdoc during an appointment who was so skeptical and said, I don't really belong to any of that Facebook, and mm-hmm. I'm not interested in doing anything
social media.
Like that with the social media. I'm mm-hmm. not interested. Well, I hear that, but I think that's a misperception that I think most people are past at this point. But it's not the same kind of platform as Facebook.
It's very different.
It is purely professional.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from maybe some people receiving spam invitations, to LinkedIn to people who don't exist. But it truly, I use it to find colleagues who have a particular skill.
Mm-hmm.
I use it every day
right.
to find people to answer questions.
Mm-hmm.
So I still use it to build my network. So I'm connecting to people I don't know almost daily. And I think the other misperception that I try to stress, again, it's not unrelated to networking, but an important point that I would share with postdocs is people are happy to help.
Yes.
Really, almost 10 times out of 10, if you contact someone just looking for information about their job,
mm-hmm.
If you're exploring your options and you don't know much about science writing, for example, if you were to contact a science writer, as I have many times,
mm-hmm.
people are happy to,
yes.
to share information about their job. And that's where I see that as a real psychological barrier for many postdocs
mm-hmm.
who feel like if I don't have a connection with someone, if I don't know someone, I'm bothering them. It's a bother. It's, that's why people hesitate to reach out.
That's very true.
That's just not true. I mean, it's really, if people and people have contacted me
mm-hmm.
For information, of course I'm happy to help. In fact, coming up this week, I have an interview with a woman who wants to serve postdocs. She
okay.
wants to be a postdoc advisor. And of course I said yes, because I'm a career counselor.
Of course.
I am truly, I am happy to help. But the same is true for most professionals I have ever met.
Mm-hmm.
They are happy to help people if they can.
Yes.
And the third thing is, I would say, so maybe all three of my points are related to networking, but to think broadly about your network. Some postdocs don't necessarily think about what they might have access to. So, for example, we talk about in counseling appointments, looking at your alma mater. Mm-hmm. So your undergrad institution, your grad institution, even some high schools have really strong alumni clubs and an alumni presence. And so I encourage people to go back and look at their undergrad and grad, approaching both the Alumni Affairs Office and the Career Center. Because at this point, we have, across the country, built many robust alumni databases in our career centers mm-hmm. that alums have access to. So it might be easy for you, if you went to Purdue, for example, right. to find a Purdue alum who's in an industry that you're interested in moving into. So those are great sources of professionals and of people in different occupations. Another good source, and this is where I try to brainstorm with people and encourage people to think creatively about networking, is your professional association. And that is, pardon me, you can certainly look at your own if you belong to ACS or APS, one of the big associations. But also, if you're looking to move into a profession that you don't know much about, you can also find real people on professional association websites. Hmm. So if you're interested in working in tech transfer, for example,
right.
if you visit the association, it's called AUTUM, the Association of University Technology Managers. I think it's just autumn.org. Mm-hmm. You can find board members, so you can find a board listed on every professional association website. And I think that's a great population to approach, because if you think about it, board members are all volunteers. They all have full-time jobs.
Right.
So first of all, they're volunteering their time. That's how much they care about the profession. But second of all, being board members, they're charged with growing the profession.
Mm-hmm.
So they're an easy group of people to approach. And I'm here to tell you, I mean, if you look at the boards of some of these organizations, the people are amazing. And their personal emails are mm-hmm. right
yes.
on their website.
Exactly.
So they're an easy group to start with, you know. And when people first reach out, for the most part, I encourage postdocs to start with email. The other piece of networking advice that I try to give is always to focus on the other person.
Mm-hmm.
So focus on the person you're contacting and express an interest in them and in their work, because that opens up conversations.
Exactly.
Rather than, you know, if you were to contact someone and ask if they have any job openings, if the answer is no, it's very hard to get that conversation back.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to keep it going. So that's where I encourage people just to focus on the other person. Also because that's flattering.
Mm-hmm.
And people tend to respond and reply positively to, wow, I'm so impressed and interested in the work that you've done. Can we schedule a time to talk on the phone?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. You know, yes, the answer is yes.
That's your answer to that question is so spot on, so perfect. I wish I could just keep that going on a loop for 40 minutes. I think that would have such a strong that would have such a strong impact to people listening. I mean, the 3 points you made, obviously, the first one, speaking about really bulking up your LinkedIn profile. I think that's extremely important from so many angles. But the easiest one is just to really start building a virtual network of people, because these websites or these social media sites, they actually help you do that, because based on your profile and the more complete your profile is, they start recommending people either that are alumni or that have similar interests or similar skill sets as you. And from there, I mean, it's almost giving you an open door to kind of follow, so that the process is a little bit easier. And I think the ability that we have to send somebody a message through LinkedIn is extremely important, because that breaks down the barrier right away, because you can essentially say, I found your profile on LinkedIn. You both understand that you have profiles on there for a particular reason. And then, you know, moving to your third point where you really start asking this person, trying to integrate yourself into what it is they're doing and really understand their field. I have not had anybody turn me down either. And I've slowly been building my network doing the same thing. And it's incredible how people are so willing to just spend a little bit of time, 10, 15 minutes, and really tell you what it is they do, because you seem genuinely interested. And you know, the other point you mentioned, the second one, using professional societies and using some of the board members on there. So again, I think that's an untapped resource a lot of people don't even recognize they have access to. So all three of those points are fantastic. I could not agree more with all three of those. So I'm...
Well, you know what I wish I had on the loop is you saying... well, actually, now I will, I guess. But no one has ever turned me down.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because I think postdocs just don't realize that. And completely. They need to hear it again and again. That people are happy to help. They mm-hmm. really are.
I can tell you for a fact, and you are proof of this right now, that even in their busy schedules, again, you're a perfect example. You're willing to take a little bit of time out to talk to somebody. I've never met you. I've never interacted with you before, but you're willing, based on a recommendation I had from Phil Clifford, one of my first interviews, to spend a little bit of time with me and chat about what you're doing. And, you know, again, this is a virtual conversation, essentially. I interact with you online. And I think that's a very powerful tool that postdocs have and graduate students have that maybe they really don't understand how powerful this is when you're looking for a job. And everybody that I've lined up for interviews, everybody that I've talked to so far, everybody in my network, I have weekly meetings with, you know, lunches, breakfast, conversations, coffee. And again, generally nobody turns me down. And if it is, it's because they're going to be out of town or they have something else to do. But they always get back in touch with me, and I completely appreciate that.
Well, in fact, I guess this interview is evidence, right?
Exactly. That's what I say.
Scientists like evidence.
Perfect example. The data is right here. And then so I have an N value of greater than 5 already. So this is significant, right?
That's right.
One of the other questions I had before we move on to maybe some more counseling questions, do you believe that there's a specific need for career counseling at the postdoc stage? Obviously, you believe that, but I'm curious, do you believe it's just at the postdoc stage? Do you believe it needs to be at graduates directed at PhD students, or do you believe it needs to be moved further back from that point? Because some of the common questions I get, or the concerns that I have, if you are a postdoc in academia, the assumption is that you are going to be pursuing an academic route. You're going to be one of those 15% that really make it through and get that academic faculty position. So you don't need somebody discouraging you or telling you to take the blinders off and explore other options. So I'm curious, do you think there is a real need for postdoc advisory boards or committees or affairs offices?
Well,
a double-edged sword.
I guess I would be out of a job if I said no. But no, seriously, I can tell you also, I have been talking to my son about job options since he was 9.
Oh, wow.
So unfortunately, he has to live with me. So I think it's never too early. I actually think we should start talking to kids in middle school, which is developmentally the first time they could actually hear us. So elementary school is a little bit young, mm-hmm. but just exposing kids to options, I think, is important.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've come a long way, you know, as evidenced, as I mentioned earlier, by the growth of postdoc offices across the country. I think there's still much work to be done. You know, I also think we have improved our grad programs over the years. I think there's a much greater focus now on career development, and I've seen that grow through my colleagues. I have been a member of a group called the Graduate Career Consortium since 1998, and that group is comprised of counselors, directors, and deans who work with graduate students and help them to make career decisions. That group has just exploded as well. It's very big now. So I know that the idea of career choice and helping graduate students with career choices is much stronger now than it ever has been in the history of the Academy. Where I still see a need, I guess, on the postdoc level is with institutional culture.
Yes.
So where we still, and I still do hear this fairly frequently, have faculty who are very well-meaning, you know, people who are generous with their time, and good mentors who really are maybe pushing people for to go for a tenure-track job. Right. So I think maybe there's a lack of awareness, although I think it's hard not to read the stories that are in not only our media outlets, you know, in higher ed, but in mass media now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've seen the Washington Post and Slate and so many articles recently about, and The Atlantic, I think, was also one of the big articles I read.
Mm-hmm.
So truly, the message is out there that there are not many faculty jobs, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really think it's a lack of awareness, but I think it's culture. I think it's the culture of institutions. I think it's, you know, training of faculty over time to be, you know, committed to this one career path. And so I think that is slower to change. So cultural change is hard at institutions that have existed for hundreds of years.
Yes.
And it's slow. And the more we can do on the faculty side in terms of education, the better. So actually, one of my plans for the fall is to start to visit the departments at Harvard to visit faculty meetings and share information with them about the NIH Biomedical Workforce Report.
Yes.
Just
very
to
important stuff.
Share information, you know, about changes over time, you know, where we've done well, what we still need to do, and just be open with communication.
Yes.
So I think sharing that kind of information with the faculty will be important.
Mm-hmm.
And I think ultimately will impact the postdocs. I hope.
Hopefully.
In a positive way.
Yes, in a positive way.
Because and I think, you know, at some level, I've also met postdocs who are not reasonable, not entirely reasonable about their expectations of faculty. So I don't think it's reasonable to expect faculty to know about other careers.
Correct.
I do think it's reasonable to expect them to know where to send you.
Mm-hmm.
If you are in their lab, they should know about resources on campus.
Yes.
And be supportive. You know, and the other great change I've seen over time is movement in the NIH, to learn about these same issues, to explore these same issues, and to try to have institutions share information with one another.
Mm-hmm.
So there are many, many of us in the country now applying for the grant that the NIH just put out in March of this year called the BEST Award,
mm-hmm.
Broadening Experiences in Scientific Training. Those awards, and they anticipate awarding, I think, between 8 and 10, and we'll find out in August how we did. But those awards are designed to introduce graduate students and postdocs to career options. And I'm excited about it, and I can tell you every single one of my colleagues applied for that award. because our budgets are small,
mm-hmm.
But we also believe this is really significant,
mm-hmm.
that the NIH is willing to put money into developing programs and having institutions share best practices
right.
around hey, what's actually going on in the job market? Where are jobs for PhD trained scientists? Mm-hmm. And let's connect those two, how we're shaping our grad programs and our postdoc training.
Right. Yeah, I believe that's extremely important as well. And it's a nice step in the right direction for the NIH to follow through with that. And unfortunately, it's hard for me to tell if this was something they've had in the works for a long time or if this is something now they're really feeling forced to do because of all the flack that maybe NIH is getting from the institutions, because they're finding out that a lot of graduate students or postdocs are becoming upset with the career options and the career tracks or the lack of options that maybe they thought they had or that they're faced with now. And then it's this kind of hierarchy of blame where the postdocs maybe blame their mentors blame the department blames the larger institution that they're housed in. And the institutions will say, NIH doesn't really give us any training to do anything else. We're mentors, we're PIs, we're here to do research. We can't also be career counselors. But your point, the point that you made of keeping an open and honest conversation, where to find these resources if your graduate student or your postdoc comes up to you and says, look, I'm really interested in tech transfer. I'm really interested in becoming to learn more about regulation or FDA regulation and where can I get this? Or can I, you know, is there a way I can get on a training grant that part of it is that I can do an internship somewhere or get this 6-week experience outside of academia to really make sure that this is my choice? I think that's, that openness is very, very important. And I'm glad that NIH is recognizing this and institutions are applying for these kind of awards because it's, I don't want to say it's too late, but it's almost getting close to a critical level where the red light's starting to flash and say you have a lot of unhappy people. It's time for something to change, and I'm glad at least something is being done about this.
I think that's right. And where I struggle, and you know, I feel some disappointment around. The way that the message is framed is often negative. But, you know, what I try to stress to postdocs that I meet and that I talk to and that I present to on different campuses, there are so many exciting choices.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that one job fits all, and I don't think that there's one perfect job for each person.
Right.
I think there are several options that would be potentially a great fit for any given person, depending on their interests and their skills and their personal values. And I think that's where I'd like to change the conversation and make it just a lot more positive.
Right.
Because there's so much growth in science and in different fields, and it's just, it's such a, and in many ways, I know it's a tough time to be in science, but it's also a great time.
Mm-hmm.
Be in science.
Yeah,
so that's what I try to stress.
Yeah, I wrote an article recently, a blog post, or an article for a blog post for a friend of mine, and I kind of made this analogy of the idea of this academic fight club where there's a mentality, there's, like you spoke of earlier, a culture that you know, there's certain rules that you need to follow if you want to become a PI, and there's really no incentive for your PI to tell you that the rules need to be any different or there are these other options. And what you have eventually at the end of the day is the hard facts where 15% of these people, at least in biological sciences, will get this prize, this carrot that's been dangling in front of their head for over a decade, that they'll become an assistant faculty member. And that when you look at the number that way, you know, if you're trying to spin things positively or negatively, that's the number that you throw out to scare people. But the number that, if you want to flip it on the other side and say there's this 85% club, and there's all these other growth industries, all these other opportunities out there for you, how come this isn't being promoted in a more positive light? I think that that would be more encouraging for postdocs to say, well, you know, the 15%, it's a tough number, but, you know, at least consider this 85%, this growth industry of 85% of alternative or non-traditional science, non-traditional faculty positions that maybe you should spend a little bit of time looking into. And by the way, here's a whole list of people that maybe were on your alumni or are here in your community that you can interact with and ask specific questions to right away before you completely jump ship.
Oh my gosh, you have no idea. I mean, that's why, as I said earlier, I think this job is such a gift, because I hear back from people. I met and worked with a postdoc who is now, this is the best job title I think I've ever heard. He is the director of bioinspiration at the San Diego Zoo. And it's so awesome. So he was an evolutionary biologist, and his job is pretty much to take a close look at the animals in the zoo, explore, you know, from insects to elephants, geckos, look at mechanisms that the animals use. How can we adapt those to serve humanity?
That's great.
Awesome. I've never heard such a job title.
It almost sounds too good to be true.
Oh my goodness. And he was so happy and just really enjoying himself. You know, I worked with another postdoc who is now designing an exhibit on climate change for the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia.
Wow.
And that's her dream job. And she was an engineer and just, you know, always has been so committed to education and telling the public about climate change, helping them to learn, and was a mentor for years and years for girls in science. And, you know, it's just so amazing to see these people doing exciting things and making these changes and contributions in science. It's just, it's so gratifying. It's the best job. So people, postdocs can also look at or think about jobs like mine.
Right. Yeah, there's, like you mentioned, it seems like there's a wealth of opportunities. And sometimes, this was something else I wrote about, sometimes it's more about understanding what your strong points are, what your really, your selling points are, and what kind of value you would add to another position. It might be, in some cases, that the specific position is not open in terms of title. So it sometimes is, it's up to you to create or innovate your own, or think in an innovative way to develop a position using your skill set that a company may never realize they had this deficiency that only you can fill, and you all of a sudden become this dream candidate because of your particular skill set. So sometimes it's maybe reading between the lines and understanding what the company needs and how you can fit yourself or how you can integrate your services in maybe a new position.
Oh, I've seen that done very well, too, with great success. So I think you're exactly right.
Right.
Absolutely.
So I'm curious, the role that you have right now, can you describe what, you know, a day in your life is like, or maybe a week, your typical week, if there is such a thing?
Sure. It looks crazy. It's very, very busy. Let's see. I have blocked off several time periods to take counseling appointments. So those are hour-long appointments. Some of my colleagues offer half an hour. But I find, especially at the postdoc level, there's so much ground to cover. I really think an hour is the minimum time I need to spend with someone to learn more about what the goals are. And then we can map out a plan, even, you know, for a meeting several times or the next time. I also am working on several different projects. At Harvard, we're currently working on a draft of a university-wide policy for postdocs, which is, it may sound like we're behind the game in some ways, but there are a few policies that exist on campus now, but the schools at Harvard have been working alone historically, and now it's important for all of the schools to look at drafting a policy that will apply to all postdocs everywhere, in Cambridge and in Boston. Our campuses are separated geographically, so it's tough to work together and to work closely on projects because we're not close to each other geographically. but we are building bridges across the Charles every day. So we're not that far apart. Working on policy, I'm also working on developing a postdoc alumni database. So that's another project that takes a big team also and many conversations and many iterations to look at what are our ultimate goals and who are we trying to serve with developing a tool like this. I also am involved with the National Postdoc Association in building an institutional policy database that is worldwide, so we can capture very quickly and easily policies that are housed at different kinds of institutions. So government agencies, for-profit companies, what's going on nationally and internationally for postdocs, where are there similarities, where are there differences. So I've been drafting and testing a policy database for them.
Okay.
For about a year.
Wow.
We also host about 50 programs a year. So another large part of my job is to map out our plans for each semester and each, usually we plan about a semester in advance. But generally for the year, we offer career and professional development programs. So based on feedback that we've heard from postdocs on past programs, which programs should we keep, what should we drop, mm-hmm. what should we add, based on skills they might want to build, grant management or English language conversation skills. I'm also a manager, so I have a staff member who reports to me in our office.
Okay.
Her title is program coordinator, so she really is the event planner in our office.
Mm-hmm.
She is also the point person. The postdocs, when they first reach out to our office, they'll reach Michaela. So,
okay. So
I also will be and am constantly working with Michaela on projects, but also providing her the support she needs to grow. I also look at the financial health of our organization. So I work with budgets, forecasting. I actually love numbers, so I prefer to, to do that work, oftentimes. I receive about 100 emails a day.
Wow.
They are, they're not all require a response because I'm on several listservs and like to keep up with news and
mm-hmm.
newsletters, but many do, and those that do often are not short answers.
Right.
So, so those, some are related to counseling appointments, follow-ups with CV reviews or questions about an impending interview, but some are even more complex, maybe a question from a faculty member about a particular grant mechanism or coding in the HR system and how should I be appointing this postdoc, and questions that just take more digging and more phone calls and just require more time.
Okay.
So it's a busy office. It's a small office. I wish it were bigger. I've been asking for more staff since I started, and budgets are tight everywhere.
Right.
But it's an exciting place, and I think there's a lot more that we can do, a lot more to be done, but I'm very grateful for all of the opportunities I have had there.
Okay. So I noticed, too, that you have a title as a consultant. I was wondering if you can explain the difference between a career counselor and a consultant, or does that terminology go hand in hand, or are the terms used synonymously, interchangeably?
No, actually, they're not the same.
Okay.
So that's a great question. The career counselor, that term, that title, is used for people who are trained in counseling. Some counselors actually feel very possessive about that word, and they're very territorial and really prefer people who offer advice to use the term career advisor. So okay. You know, I'm not one of those people, even though I went through counselor training. Mm-hmm. It's hard. Counselor training includes, I think it was 600 hours of supervised counseling. And, it's a hard, rigorous program. But that is different from the consulting that I do, because I've also served universities and institutions on developing postdoc offices, postdoc programs, people who have questions, mm-hmm. Who need someone to do sustained work on designing an office, a program, a series of programs. I also serve as a consultant slash speaker. So people will often call on me for speaking engagements.
Okay.
And so that's why I retain that title and my independent work, because that's outside of the realm of my job. Mm-hmm. In some cases, in other cases, it's also work that I can do as an ambassador for Harvard, but that's the difference. So being paid a consulting fee, for example, to give a talk, that's also something I do.
Okay, and how often do you get to travel or give talks, seminars, workshops? Is this 10, 20% of your job, or would you say this is few and far between?
Let's see. No, I would say in between those two. I give probably 8 to 10 talks a year.
Okay.
Some at large conferences, some at schools with fairly small postdoc populations. Sometimes people can find money in their budget for a speaker when they don't have an office yet.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, that happened recently. This year was in February. I went to the University of Connecticut. They actually invited me to serve as their keynote speaker for, a great honor for their graduate student symposium.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they had the money to bring me in as just a one-time speaker, but they don't have a postdoc office yet. And they do serve graduate students in their career center, but they're trying to do more. So opportunities like that, when they arise, I'm happy to help if I can afford the time, mm-hmm. if I can afford the travel away from my family. And it's truly, of all of the things that I do, public speaking is one of my absolute favorites.
Really?
I love it. Love it. And just, I enjoy it every time I do it.
That's great. I should make a note here, too, that we're trying to get Melanie to come out to the Madison campus here in Wisconsin at the end of August, and I think she will also be making a trip up to MCW in Milwaukee as Phil Clifford's guest. So hopefully we'll get to see some of this public speaking in real life, real form. So, yeah, we definitely look forward to it. I'm curious, too, you've mentioned some of the highlights of your career, some of the positive aspects or things that you really like. I'm curious if there are things that you don't necessarily like as much.
Well, you know what has happened over time, and I think this may be true for most professionals, but I have grown to be more interested in big picture ideas and themes and working across institutions and doing more, I guess, at that level, at a higher level than working day to day, doing the same tasks. So that's where I've seen a real change personally. And email is very hard for me because it's important to me to serve as many people as I can, but with the volume, the sheer volume, I just I can't always get back to people in in the period of time that I think is reasonable. and that bothers me, and that and I've heard the same, and I've read several articles about email taking over our lives, but that is something I don't enjoy, and I but that's partly because I'm not very good at it. So I've also invited a great speaker who is from Australia. He has written several books. His name is, oh my gosh, his name just flew out of my head. Okay, I will have to send you his name.
Yes, definitely do that.
He's given a time management series for us.
Okay.
And a lot of what he talks about is managing email mm-hmm. and when to shut it off and work on your work that requires focus, like mm-hmm. writing, if you're working
yes.
on a manuscript. And that is really an area that I'm not very good at. So
I
can say, yeah, it's not just that I dislike that part of my job, it's that I'm not as good at, mm-hmm. at that part of my job as I am at other things.
Okay.
So yeah, I think over time, and that's the other reason I've been asking for more staff, I would like for someone to be able to take over more of the day-to-day mm-hmm. and give me more time just to think, because I am definitely an idea person.
Right. Yeah. I've interacted with two people recently, so I'm pretty interested in the process of tech transfer. And I had asked one of my colleagues that gave a seminar, I asked them how much time they spend, if they can divide up their day. And they said, they mentioned something, they spend more than 20% of their day just answering emails. And that sounds, it sounds very overwhelming. And the time management aspect, the last person that I just interviewed here, Alan Dove, he's a science journalist. And he mentioned the exact same thing. He'll dedicate his, you know, an hour or two in the morning to answering email, getting caught up on all the social media, and then for him to work uninterrupted, he needs all of that stuff off. And I think that's probably a good policy to follow every single time that you're trying to do work, because multitasking when you're, you know, writing or when you're trying to think about grant ideas or figures for a publication or putting a presentation together, it's not very easy if you have your phone beeping every single time a new text message or an email or a Twitter feed come up. It's probably just best to hide that stuff in a box for a little while.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I don't know if you're an NPR listener,
mm-hmm.
but Peter Sagal actually joked about that recently. He had to, I can't remember how he said it, but I think he said he had to lock himself out of his email in order to work.
that makes sense.
I mean, it's just a huge temptation and mm-hmm. a time sink. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
So, but I think everyone's facing it. So I'm grateful for that, because mm-hmm. then I think people have more patience with me.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
You know.
People understand how much of your time is truly devoted to actually doing work versus answering emails. I think they probably get a better gauge on that you're trying to be productive. It's not that you're putting them off, but you're just trying to be productive at what you're getting paid to do.
That's right. Or having a postdoc walk in with a crisis, or
yes,
answering
right.
a staff member who has questions, or fill in the blank.
Yeah.
You know, it's harder to turn people down who are standing in front of you.
Right. Exactly.
But, you know. So
have there been any particular trends in the sessions as you've, I guess, or the counseling sessions you've been going through that you've noticed in the last year? Is there maybe now more of an urgency to explore alternative career options, or are people starting to get more frustrated with the system that they're in, or are there particular issues that come up consistently that you can really track as a trend that fit with, I don't know, an economic crisis or a job crisis or something that maybe is a deficiency in career development? I'm curious if you can comment on that.
Oh, absolutely. And it's been very interesting for me to see the change over time. And I'm sure this, again, is in response to the publicity and the mm-hmm. and the media around the academic job market. But the postdocs I've worked with over the past 2 years are much more accepting, I think.
Yes.
Either way, that doesn't mean that they are not applying for academic jobs. They just seem much more, practical, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they are much more accepting of the fact that it's important to be applying to other types of jobs or have a backup plan. Or not, and recognize that they may not get a job.
Mm-hmm.
They seem much more open and quick to acknowledge that the shift in the market.
Mm-hmm.
So that is different. That has changed over time, because I certainly can remember not that many years ago working with grad students and postdocs who were focused on an academic job search and really didn't talk about, didn't mention, didn't acknowledge the fact that it was bad.
Right.
And it's been bad for decades.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So this is, it's not exactly a new story. It is worse than it's ever been mm-hmm. right now. But it has not been a great job market for PhDs for literally decades, since the 90s.
Yes.
And people are okay, not okay with it, because it's still disappointing for some people who only want to move into that job, mm-hmm. but they just seem much more accepting,
right.
Maybe more at peace with that idea.
I think that
so
makes,
that's different.
Yeah, that makes quite a lot of sense. So are you generally encouraged? I mean, this is a two-tiered question. Are you generally encouraging for postdocs or graduate students that are looking at alternative careers? And do you have particular suggestions for them as a career counselor? And then on top of that, do you notice in your conversations with postdocs or graduate students that there's maybe a disconnect from what their PI expects from them versus what they expect from their PI or what they expect from this quote-unquote training period or apprenticeship as a postdoc?
I'm sorry, I missed the beginning of that.
Oh, sorry.
Can you repeat that?
Sure. Yeah. The first part I was curious about of this, you know, very long-winded question is: are you starting to notice some of the PhDs or postdocs really exploring alternative careers as a possibility? And then, I mean, how do you encourage them, or is this something that you encourage? And do you have a specific method for them to pursue these careers? And then on top of that, are the postdocs or graduate students that are coming to you looking to explore these alternative careers, are they coming to you because they feel there's a disconnect between what their PI expects of them versus what they expect from their PI?
Wow, that's a big question.
Yeah.
So what I encourage people to do is born of the career development process, and that is a four-tiered process.
Okay.
With the first tier being self-assessment, mm-hmm. and that involves taking a closer look at what is most important to you in a job, what really excites you, what motivates you, and also what you're good at. And that is something that we explore in several different ways through informal exercises where I might just have a worksheet or an exercise on paper that I have postdocs do. We also can get to the answers of some of those questions by talking, brainstorming, mm-hmm. Having several counseling sessions. We also use formal assessments. So in my office, we use the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator and the Strong Interest Inventory.
Okay.
So those are two formal assessments that postdocs can take online for free, and then we sit together and we interpret their results. And those can be helpful instruments for people who really feel like they don't know where to start and have no idea about different job options or the world of work.
Mm-hmm.
So I encourage people really to get to know themselves better first. And then the second stage of career development, of the career development process, is career exploration.
Okay.
So once they know themselves better, then we take a look at, well, what occupations are even out there and which of those match who you said you are, mm-hmm. or who you are, right, based on our work together.
Okay.
And so in that stage, people do a lot of informational interviewing where they'll contact professionals in different fields and they'll learn more about the jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And those can be so helpful in identifying either what you might like to do or a job that you would not like at all. So that's also good information. So from there, people are slowly, through the career exploration process, narrowing down their choices, and then they reach the third stage, and that is goal setting.
Okay.
So at that point, if they find, okay, I'm definitely going for tech transfer, they've talked to people maybe in a university tech transfer office, and they find, okay, well, people who are going into this field have concrete work experience in this kind of office, or have a coursework in business, or, you know, they find out maybe some gaps that they're missing in their CV, and then they set goals to fill those gaps.
Okay.
So either taking courses, or our OTD at Harvard offers an internship program for postdocs, which is terrific because postdocs can work there and learn more about the process and contribute and actually work on some agreements. So it's very exciting, and it's a good entry for their CVs, and
right.
And they also build their network
yes.
in that profession. So the fourth stage is the actual job search.
Yes.
So once you've built these skills, what do you need to do to apply for jobs? You need to get your materials ready. You need to build your profile online.
Mm-hmm.
You know, start reaching out to people, forwarding your CV, applying for jobs. And that is typically the first stage we go to in the U.S. And that's, mm-hmm. of course, that makes sense because people have to pay the bills and have to feed their families, and that is logical.
Mm-hmm.
However, we have, in career development theory, we have decades of data to prove that if you spend more time in the first stage thinking about yourself and what's important to you, what's most important to you, the chances that you will find a match in a job that is more satisfying, where you'll be more productive, and where you'll stay in the job longer, is so much stronger.
Okay.
So it's, you know, that sounds like common sense, but that's why we suggest people, you know, really devote themselves. In terms of a disconnect between a PI's, maybe a PI's aspirations for a postdoc mm-hmm. and the postdoc's actual aspirations, I don't know. I mean, I've heard different scenarios, of course, many different situations, different kinds of relationships, but
mm-hmm.
yeah, I've certainly heard of PIs who are supportive of any career option. I've heard PIs who are supportive of academic or faculty positions for their postdoc, and their postdoc really wants to do that.
Yeah.
And then I've heard the opposite. You know, so I can't say one way or the other because I don't have the data.
Okay.
You know, what, where faculty perceptions really lie.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that we wrote into our grant. So we wrote in measurement not only of postdoc perceptions of faculty acceptance of their choices,
mm-hmm.
But also faculty perceptions of non-tenure track
right.
Jobs, so non-academic jobs. And it will be exciting if we get it, but we won't find out until August. But that's not unlike Cynthia Furman's paper, if anyone's interested in learning more about mm-hmm. The group that she assessed at UCSF. In San Francisco, she looked at a group of people, or graduate students, and measured their perceptions of faculty.
Okay.
Faculty ideas about careers and what changed over time from when they first started their programs to when they were in their programs for a longer period of time. And that's interesting work. We need to do more work on that score because we don't have a lot of data to measure. We have anecdotes.
Okay.
And I'm sure you have many, and I'm sure
yes,
a lot of postdocs, you know, at UW have many, but
mm-hmm.
some good, some bad, but what we actually need is data.
Right, right. So along those lines, a lot of the people that you interact with are graduate students and postdocs. So can you get a sense from them, or I mean, also being a career counselor from and a recruiter previously, can you get a sense of the value of having a PhD? Do you still believe that there's a dire need to have a PhD to pursue certain positions, or do you think that the skills you get as a PhD trainee can be picked up anywhere?
No, I don't. I really do think that the training matters in terms of not only in intangible skills like perseverance, but also in terms of skills you can measure, like the ability to write, the ability to think critically, the ability to analyze data, the ability to understand complex ideas and maybe translate them for a lay audience.
Yes.
I do think that the training matters, and I think that the skills people develop in PhD programs are so valuable. And I think those are skills that are valued by employers.
Right.
As I mentioned, what really matters is what matters most to you, the person applying.
Mm-hmm.
Where do your interests lie? What have you thought about? What have you always been curious about? You know, that's what matters. I've met people who are engineers interested in genomics. I mean, there's so much cross-pollination now, too, and there are so many people who are working in an interdisciplinary way. I think that's exciting. I think there's so much work that we can do. People who are trained in one discipline but working in another can contribute in ways that we've never imagined.
Right.
So, I think that training is invaluable.
Okay.
Still.
Yeah.
And I think employers feel the same.
Okay. That's very encouraging to hear from somebody that has experience as a recruiter and also a career counselor. I think, their belief that there is still value in having a PhD and the area and the tracks that you can follow with these letters and this experience after your name is still very important. I think that's very encouraging because some people, I've also seen a lot of articles, don't waste your time going to graduate school or PhD is going to get you nowhere kind of thing. And again, it's banking on a lot of this, this fear of taking advantage of everybody's fear that they're not going to get a position and essentially blaming the pursuit of a PhD and what comes after that instead of, the economy or the job market or just the lack of innovation of really trying to understand what you can do outside of the traditional path of tenure track academic faculty position. So I completely agree with you. There's quite a lot of value to having a PhD for all those reasons that you mentioned. I completely agree with that. So moving forward, do you see in terms of the progression and obviously, people are going to keep getting their PhD, keep going to higher education, and the job market's still going to be very unpredictable. What are some of your biggest concerns with some of the people that you're counseling as they're moving through with their PhD or taking on postdoc positions? Do you advise them? Are there certain signs, roadblocks, or things they should yield at that and maybe take into consideration?
Well, if we're talking about current grad students, my message that I mentioned earlier is the same, that it is never, ever too early to start thinking about your career.
Options,
ever.
Okay.
So first day of grad school, you just arrived. That is not too early.
Right.
Because people can, leave with a master's, find a job, and be so happy and just feel satisfied going to work every day. That's where I would encourage people to really, think carefully about themselves, their skills and their values and their goals for being in graduate school.
Okay.
I think the trap that we've fallen into in the U.S. Has so much to do with funding. I think graduate school, and then actually subsequently the postdoc. Graduate school is an easy, in some ways, place to go if you are an undergraduate who has really enjoyed his or her discipline and does not know what to do next.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Because we have funded so many graduate students over the past few decades, it's been fairly easy for people in terms of funding mm-hmm. to move into a program.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So if you're being paid to go to school,
yes.
that's, well, in the eyes of you know, an undergraduate, that's exciting and
exactly.
and can be very appealing and really powerful, right?
Mm-hmm.
However, they may not know how little or realize how little you know, graduate student stipends actually are, how difficult they are to live on, but much more than that, don't recognize that graduate school is a very expensive, time-consuming,
yes.
and stressful way to figure out what you really want to do. You know, and I think the same can almost be said about postdocs, because mm-hmm. postdocs historically have been so easy to find. It's still an incredibly informal process where, and I know you know this and the listeners probably know this, mm-hmm. You know, you contact someone who's doing work that you're interested in, you send an email, I'd like to work in your lab looking for a postdoc. Sure.
Yes.
Yes. The answer is yes.
Right.
You have a job.
Right.
Come on in. You know? And it's been so easy to find a job. I think that has also encouraged a delay mm-hmm. in decision-making for the postdoc population.
Right.
Right?
Correct.
So you're leaving grad school. Uh-oh, same question. I'm not sure what to do next. Oh, well, I'll find a postdoc. No problem. I've heard graduate students I've had graduate students sit with me and say exactly that. Like, I'm not sure what to do next, so I'm actually just going to get a postdoc.
Yep.
you know, again, that is delaying the inevitable, that mm-hmm. you will have to make a decision one day and try to put piece together work that you find interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And going through that process is critical because you will spend most of your time at work.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it is important for you to enjoy, hopefully, most of the time, what you're doing and the people you're doing it with.
Right.
Right. So you know, I'm irritated by some of the messages that have been sent out from the administration about you know, lack of PhDs or shortage of PhDs, right?
Mm-hmm.
In science, I think those are more fueled by the influx of PhDs from other countries,
mm-hmm.
right? I think that had a negative impact in enrollment growing in lots of our programs in the mm-hmm. U.S. So I don't know. I think things will flatten out over time in terms of our enrollment because people. We haven't even really seen a great decrease in enrollment in grad programs.
Yeah.
In response to any job market changes, right? So, they're, you know, graduate students and postdocs are cheap labor.
Yes, very cheap.
Unfortunately, right? So if you look at the economics of it, and if you have not read Paula Stefan's book, you need to run. Not walk to the library and to check it out because
okay.
it is awesome.
Okay.
It's called How Economics Shapes Science.
Hmm.
And she talks about exactly this. She talks about how we've perpetuated this system because these very talented, very smart, driven young people have been in a system that does not reward them monetarily, and that system has gone on and been in place for far too long.
Yeah.
So, you know, the recommendations that grew out of the biomedical workforce report, some of the most important ones, and I've heard Dr. Stefan say this, were not adopted, and those included, you know, significant increase in postdoc stipends, and mm-hmm. And that's too bad because they are underpaid, and in some cases, underpaid by a lot.
Yes.
So, you know, so there are still, we still have a lot of work to do, but I am encouraged by the changes that I've seen. And really, I mean, 15 years is, it's not that much time when you think about, you know, universities beginning in the U.S. in 1636.
Right.
So 15 years is not that much time for me to have seen so many significant changes and growth that I find encouraging.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that trend will continue.
Okay. That's very, very positive to hear. I, at least, you know, coming from the perspective that I have as a postdoc, I like a lot of the changes that I'm seeing take place. Of course, I wish they would happen quicker, and I wish more institutions and universities would adopt these globally. But it's like you said, to see this kind of change over 15 years, I think that's a significant step in the right direction, and very very hope inspiring for the long run. Yeah, that's. I can't say enough about how important it is to have career advice and career counseling as you're moving through graduate school, but also as a postdoc and being able to kind of bounce ideas off somebody that's familiar with the field and kind of is able to walk you through this assessment or the correct steps. I mean, you mentioned those four tiers that you had talked about. Those are extremely important when you're looking for a job, because ultimately you want to be doing something that's going to make you happy, not something you're going to be complaining about every single day.
That's exactly right.
Exactly. So the last question I have for you, and I think you might have touched on this here and there, but for somebody that's interested in following in your footsteps, what kind of career advice would you give them if they they're very interested in counseling or consulting?
That is a great question. I would say get out there, network, volunteer, join the NPA. The NPA is constantly looking for volunteers to serve on their committees. It is a fantastic growth opportunity for any person, I think, both personally and professionally.
Excellent. And with that, I would like to thank our guest this week here at the Postdoc Way, Melanie Cinch, for sharing her experience, advice, and wisdom. It's truly been an honor and a pleasure, and I look forward to continued interactions with Melanie in the future. I'd like to thank all of you for listening and hope that you tune in next week when we have future guests here at the Postdoc Way. Thank you. I'm Brian Jarecki.